Hello, and welcome back to The Civic Flame. I'm your host, Dr. Vail. Last week, we began our discussion on the legislative branch, or Article 1. If you're just joining us and you want the whole overview, go back to our first week, where we started the discussion about the Declaration of Independence and the preamble and how they're related and what the heck they mean for American law. Last week, it was Article 1, Section 1, and we did a whole episode on a single sentence and what was called the non-delegation doctrine, as well as why we have two houses of Congress. Today, we're looking at how we got the House of Representatives, why it's been capped at 435 members, and how that shapes what's going on in the government as we dig deeper into Article 1. Article 1, Section 1 deals with everybody's favorite body of government, the U.S. House of Representatives, and given what we know, this is the least favorite branch of government consistently. Most people like this branch of government just about as much as they like smallpox and Brussels sprouts. So you might want to grab your barf bag as we go through. But you also might be asking, how can this possibly be the case when Congress usually has an 80% or higher incumbency or re-election rate? Easy. There are 435 of them. The only one you need to like is yours, and most people do. So you can hate the heck out of the other 435, and most people do, and they don't care. As long as 50 plus 1% of voters, not even people, just voters, in that congressperson's district, they get reelected. This leads to people hating, quote, Congress as a whole, but being okay with their person. And it creates for some really interesting friction when people look at the government. So let's dig into these crazy branches, starting with the House. Article 1, Section 2, the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for the electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state in which he shall be chosen. This section of the Constitution is called the Qualifications Clause. So when you hear people talking about how much they don't like their government, how much they want to have term limits for Congress, that has repeatedly been struck down. There's a case in the 90s called U.S. v. Thornton term limits, or U.S. term limits v. Thornton. Thornton was there. U.S. term limits were there. It was a case in the 90s. You can go to OYEZ.org, and they actually do a lot of really good information. And so you can check that out. But there was a Supreme Court case, and one of the things that the court said and has said repeatedly in other cases is the Constitution was clear in the Qualifications Clause. These are the qualifications. You can't add more. You can't take any away unless you're doing it by amendment. And how we know, the Constitution doesn't actually give term limits to the presidents either until the constitutional amendment with the 22nd Amendment. So it became the idea, if you want term limits for the House, for the Senate, for the courts, you have to change the Constitution, right? Because of what I just read you, the Qualifications Clause. There's another section, if you go through and read the main document, that talks about taxes. That was eventually changed. And then we get to some interesting questions about how we choose members of Congress. So this is what they call the enumeration, what we would later come to think of really as the census. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of years, in such manner as they shall by law direct. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative. And until such enumeration shall be made, the state of New Hampshire shall be entitled to choose 3, Massachusetts, 8, Rhode Island and Providence Plantation, 1, just to be clear, the woo wasn't in the Constitution, Connecticut, 5, New York, 6, New Jersey 4, Pennsylvania 8, Delaware 1, sad Delaware, Maryland 6, Virginia 10, why are they always getting everything? North Carolina 5, South Carolina 5, and Georgia 3. That's the original shape of the government. You have really populous states like Pennsylvania and Virginia having large numbers. Massachusetts also has 8. And so this became the proportional government. Remember with that Articles of Confederation, there was only one House of Congress, and it kind of made a lot of people upset. One of the biggest constitutional compromises was this question of how do we represent by population, but how do we also have equal representation by state? We want to balance the state's rights versus, right, the population. So we want the state of Georgia, which only has 3 members of Congress, at least to have some level of control over their state government. And so for that, we have the Senate, which we talk about next time, which is where everybody gets the same number. But the question of what about really populous states? What about Virginia that's got 10? Should they have to be beholden to equal representation in the Senate where everybody gets 2 when they represent so many more people? This is still a question we're fighting about today. California has over 50 members of the House of Representatives because it is a massively populous state. The last time I read statistics, and this was a few years ago, 1 in every 33 Americans lived in Los Angeles County, right? There's a lot of people there versus places like Wyoming that only has 1, right? And so you've got about 530,000, give or take, people who live in Wyoming. They get 1 member of Congress. And so it tends to go back and forth as a question of when we're talking about federal power, how much power should the federal government have just because one state has fewer people in Congress? But then, of course, the question becomes, well, how much power should the Senate have? How much power should those 500,000 people in Wyoming have over the, you know, millions of people in California? And this question kind of goes back and forth, and it's really one that we can't answer with a black and white answer. You kind of have to answer by degree and say, oh, well, there's this much inequality that the system can tolerate. And at the point of developing our Constitution, this was the way that that inequality, majority rule, minority rights, states' rights, individual rights, federal rights, all tried to be sort of navigated. Whether it works or not, I don't know. It always works. It always doesn't work. It depends on where you're standing very often. And so they give a little bit of a conversation about how to fill vacancies, things like that. One of the really interesting clauses is actually about the Speaker of the House, right? So the Constitution says, the House of Representatives shall choose their Speaker and other officers and shall have the sole power of impeachment. So there aren't a lot of places in the Constitution that really stipulate like specific offices in Congress. So like the Senate kind of elects their Senate leader. But this came to a head last summer and the summer before because the Constitution requires the Speaker of the House of Representatives to be elected by the members of the House. And we actually had one of the longest times in U.S. history without an elected Speaker of the House because the government kind of couldn't get it together and couldn't make a choice. And there was a lot of trade-offs and back dealing. And this does a couple things. The role of the Speaker of the House is kind of to direct traffic in what's going on. They don't have a ton of power necessarily, but as the Speaker of the House has gained more power, particularly since 1992 with Newt Gingrich, what you see is the House of Representatives becoming more polarized. Because if the Speaker has more power, they can set the rules for who's on what committee. Now, there is a lot of committees in the House of Representatives. Typically, those committees look kind of like the general like body of the House. So if there's 40% of the House of Representatives is Democrats and 60% are Republicans, then that's what the committee will look like, right? You have 10 people on it, 4 will be Democrats, 6 will be Republicans. And so the committees are meant to be kind of representative of the partisanship in the House itself. But what the Speaker can do is kind of weigh in on who gets to be on the committee. And so what that means is members of the House of Representatives want to be buddy-buddy with the Speaker because they want to get on that committee. And the Speaker can also have certain rules about what bills actually get up into the House of Representatives for them to talk about. So the Speaker has a lot of power. And they can use that power to direct traffic. They can use that power to make people be more moderate and say, if you're extreme, if you're radical, I'm not putting you on a committee. Or they can go the other way and say, if you are extreme or you are radical, that's the way to get on the committee. And so that can really have a big impact on what's going on in the House of Representatives. But you have to have a Speaker of the House before you can do anything, because the Constitution requires it. So there was a whole lot of time when we the people were paying taxes, by the way, for a government that wasn't doing anything except trying to elect a Speaker of the House. And so it was a really interesting scenario where you're kind of like, wow, I mean, what are they doing? And they were not able to kind of get that Speaker going. And then they did, and the work went on as normal. The other one is an interesting one of shall have the sole power of impeachment. And this is something that's neat about the Constitution, because we know when the Constitution wants to give a single power to only a single group, it is clear, right? The House has the sole power of impeachment. And it says that. We also know when they want to deny powers from groups. We'll talk about that in Article 1, Section 8, and Section 9, of what powers are explicitly given and what powers are definitely denied. But as I tell my students a lot, there is clarity often on what the law requires, and there is clarity often on what the law forbids. But there's a lot of question about this big middle space of what does the law allow? And we're not sure. And we'll have some of those conversations as we go through. But with this, it is, okay, we know you forbid anybody else from having the powers of impeachment. We've drawn a box around that and said House of Representatives only. And so what you notice about this section also, we have 435 members of Congress, but I didn't read that number anywhere in the text for you, not because I skipped it, but because we don't have it in the Constitution. The idea that term limits need to be added through amendment comes from that qualifications clause, right? We said everything you need to do to be in the House is listed here, but we never actually said how many people you need. And a part of this is the founders meant Congress to grow with the people, because the House of Representatives is the closest branch to the people, right? So you have one president who represents the whole country. You have two senators that represent the whole state. And then you have one member of Congress who represents your little district, your town, your county, your city, your whatever. They're supposed to be closest to the people. So that's why we have a Senate that says very clearly, two from every state, that's all you get. The House of Representatives is a different question, because they're supposed to have enough of them that they can have meaningful relationships with their constituents. They're supposed to go home to their districts. They're supposed to pound the pavement. They're supposed to talk to the people. So how do we get the 435 number? Well, NPR actually does a really good in-depth report called Stuck at 435 Representatives, Why the U.S. House Hasn't Grown with Census Counts. And the gist of the article is to explain that for most of early U.S. history, nobody lost votes when the population grew. The House just got bigger, right? You didn't take anybody away. So today, when we do that census every 10 years, your state might lose one. When I was in college, Massachusetts had 10 members of the House of Representatives, and I got to do an internship for Congressman John Oliver in the summer of 2001. And not John Oliver, not the comedian, right? The congressman who was super cool, big environmentalist guy, which stressed my family out, because some of them didn't know when I started college again. And I left on September 1st or August 31st of 2001. And if you know anything about history, on September 11th of 2001, the Pentagon was hit by an airplane in a terrorist attack, and it was really very seriously chaotic. And so a lot of my family didn't know where I was because I had been working for John Oliver, but I was safely back in Massachusetts at school, panicking for, you know, the reasons the rest of the American public was panicking. But it was a neat experience. I really liked it. And I remember looking at the map and being like, man, Massachusetts really spends all our resources on Boston, which is something you'll hear me say again. But it was like, okay, we've got a big enough population. We are one of the third most densely populated U.S. states, and we've got 10 representatives. Well, in 2010, when they did the census again, we actually lost one. And it was John Oliver's district that went to somebody that I don't particularly care for. And so we lost a member of Congress, and another state gained a member of Congress. This is really difficult for states because it kind of changes the way that your ability to govern works, right? Your power, your ability to be heard. Massachusetts wasn't really paying less in taxes, but we did have one fewer representative. And so this is something that didn't happen in the early republic. It wasn't that you just took that one away and Massachusetts now has only 10. It would be like, oh, okay, Kentucky has more people. I guess we need to add another chair in Congress. And so that's what would have happened. And so it really does reshape the structure of politics, of the committees, of the representation, of the relationship with the people. And so in the past couple of years, there have been quiet but consistent questions of whether we should do this. Because again, the Constitution does not itself say 435. The House of Representatives has actually an article about this. It's called The Permanent Apportionment Act of 1929. And you might want to go to the Wikipedia page about it, because if you're reading the article itself, it's like, whoa, okay, I get it. It's a law. But it explains that in 1929, people thought the House of Representatives was getting too big. So they decided we're going to cap it at 435. And this becomes an interesting political question, right? The founders intended the House to grow with the nation. It's the people's house. It's supposed to be small, supposed to have districts, right? They're supposed to be geographically and culturally concise. There are some interesting people doing work on gerrymandering. That's the way that politicians shape a congressional district to pick voters that are favorable to them or that are not favorable to whoever they don't like. There are nonpartisan districting commissions that can do this, that come in and say, no, we're going to make it fair and here's how we're going to do it. One of the interesting bits of research done is saying you should do it by postal zip codes because that actually keeps communities together and it keeps it in a space where when the congressperson comes back to their district, you know, they have an easy way to travel. You have an easy way to get to them, to get to their offices, because they're supposed to represent the ground level of democracy, we the people. What the founders wanted and whether we should care about that is a theoretical problem. A practical one, when talking about the way the 435 districts shape the United States, obviously is there's only one member of Congress for each small district, and is it fair or not fair for how that's going to work? And I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that if we add members to Congress, we do have to pay them. And so I know that in terms of practical considerations, expanding the house, expanding the office buildings, expanding the staff, and expanding the budget is going to be something a lot of people don't like. I often tell my students, you hate Congress because Congress wants you to hate them, right? Because Congress wants you to be antagonistic, because whenever they do anything bad, you kind of ignore it because it's what you expect. You're like, oh, well, they suck anyway. But it's also, I think, because if we don't like them, we won't add more. And if we added more, it would dilute the power of the 435. Whenever you hear people talking about, oh, the establishment, oh, this. Well, if we added 100 more people, that would dilute the power of the establishment to some extent, arguably, at least in the short term, much better than term limits would. Term limits really don't do much. In fact, they can actually be harmful because you have all these new people coming in who, you know, you're putting your hand on their shoulder as a lobbyist and saying, don't worry, I got you. I can show you how to write this model legislation. And the people who can't run anymore just go work for the lobbying firms. So there's a push and pull of how do we make this better. One way is by adjusting the way we pay members of Congress and making that related to their district, right? So you'll say the median salary in your district is $40,000. So you can't make any more than twice that, right? You can't make any more than $80,000. You can't make any more than $120,000. That would be one way that we could actually say, okay, this is how we're going to pay Congress equitably. And you're not, you know, and we're going to try to find a way to do it. But I don't know, it would be kind of a wild and crazy ride to try to convince people to add more people to Congress. And this is, you know, obviously, as I said, it comes from that Articles of Confederation it was what the Connecticut Compromise, right? You're drafting the Constitution, you want equal representation, but again, you want proportional representation. So we try to navigate how that's going to work. But if California has 39.4 million people and Wyoming has 587,000, I just looked that up, then what does that mean in terms of who's getting represented? One representative in California represents just over, just under 760,000 people. In Wyoming, it's one representative is 587,618 people. But the population of Rhode Island is 1.1 million. And the population of Montana is 1.3 million or 1.13 million. And they each have two representatives. The population of Delaware is 1 million and they only have one. And so, you know, it goes over and over of like, okay, so Delaware has a million people and one representative. Wyoming has 587,000 people and one representative. There's a big gap there. Typically, what you see is one person in Congress representing 700 to 800,000 people. That seems to be the line. There's like 100,000 that we allow as flexibility, right? How much inequality are you going to allow? But again, you have some people representing 500,000 or 600,000, some people representing a million. That's a lot more inequality. How do you do that meaningfully without taking away from states that already have a large population their representatives? You could add more people, right? The U.S. population is not going down, contrary to popular theory. Yes, in some places, the white population of the U.S. is going down, but that's not the same thing as population decline, broadly speaking. So what happens in 20 years when we have another generation and we still only have 435 people in Congress, because the boomers are obviously never going to die. They're going to live forever. So we have them, and they're probably going to run Congress forever, by the way. The average age of Congress is old. You can look that up. It's depressing. And it's the average age is old and the average salary is rich, right? So there's structural problems with people who kind of are out of touch with modern issues, including climate change, including technology, but who also have a lack. It's not the age thing. It's the lack of cognitive flexibility, right? The lack of pivoting to what is the modern world. So many times when Joe Biden stood up to talk, it was like, that would have been a great barn burner of a speech in 1976. But today the world is different and what you're talking about no longer exists. And so as long as you have that issue, and then you have the economic issue where Congress is really economically out of touch, a lot of Congress is economically out of touch with the American people, then, you know, you have people hating them. And so you can say every 2 years we can reelect them, throw them all out. Or, right, you can say maybe we should add in a bunch of new people. Right? This is a good way to get in a bunch of new people, is to add seats to the House of Representatives. That would lead to a big honking fight, but who knows, right? Who knows what could happen? And it leads to a lot of frustration, because people really do feel stuffed into electoral districts that don't represent them. They feel like either it's gerrymandering or it's the non-responsive member of Congress because of their age, because of their, you know, policies, because of their ideas about technology, because of their wealth. And so off and on, there really has been different ways to say, how do we make the people's branch more responsive to the people? Inevitably, the government's not going to be perfect. It's never going to be perfect. That's just life, right? The point is to ask, how much compromise is acceptable? How much does our compromise of the House of Representatives and the Senate lean into the imperfections and go that way? Or how much do we, the people, drive up their ability to fix it, right? And say, no, you're going to find middle ground and we're going to drag you to it. And every piece of legislation has to pass the House and the Senate identically. So this is an interesting question, right? Because even if we do increase the numbers, when they're writing laws, remember, Article 1, legislative branch, this is the branch that legislates the laws. This is the branch that writes the laws. Any article that has to do with money starts in the House of Representatives itself. And so when they're writing the laws, they have to pass the House and the Senate identically before they can go to the president. So it wouldn't change the lawmaking itself, like the policy. You still have to have them agree on what's going on. But it could change the shape of the agreement. It could change the scope of the amendments. It could change the priorities, or it could not, right? That's the other thing. We never fully know what is going to happen. But so whatever happens, whatever issues with representation to get a law are going to be reflected in the law. And so that is something that I think a lot of people, even if they don't verbalize, even if they don't really understand it in those terms, do ask very often, you know, why should these laws that are written by people who don't represent me govern me? To some extent, because that's life in a democracy, but to other extents, there are an awful lot of well-funded lobbyists that pay an awful lot of money to members of Congress, and lobbyists have no place in the Constitution. The only reason that they're allowed is that the Supreme Court says they're free speech. Whether that's true or not is a different question for a different time, but it is one of those issues we have to contend with whenever we're asking about these kinds of questions. One of the last things from section two, because I know I've just fire hosed you again, I've thrown so much at you, is, you know, again, this question of what does it matter to have a specific power dedicated to the House of Representatives. Here it's an impeachment. As we'll talk about in section eight, there's like a lot of enumerated powers, what's called enumerated powers. And what this shows us again is that when the framers wanted something specific, they said it, right? And as you'll notice so far going through, this has really been about structure. It hasn't been about individual rights, because as a lot of the Constitution, the idea was the people have the rights. We're not going to put them in the Constitution because it's not our job. It's not our thing. It's not our area, right? That's for the people. What the Constitution does is set up the architecture. And so that's what it's doing. It's setting up the architecture to some extent. It's saying, here's some powers that only you can have. You can't have, right? You can't delegate Article 1, Section 1 from last week, non-delegation doctrine. Only Congress has these powers. It gets a little less clear when it's like the House versus the Senate, who gets what power to do what. We'll get into that a little bit next time. But these kinds of questions of non-delegation, of how many members of the House of Representatives we can have, and all of that stuff really will continue to be questions that the voters have to answer and may be questions that the Supreme Court ends up having to get to. So it's been interesting talking about Congress. I know a lot of people don't know a lot about Congress because they just can't stand hearing the sound of their voices. I understand that. I've been there. I get that. Congress is interesting. And what you can do if you're not sure, because a lot of Americans actually don't know who their member of Congress is, what you can actually do is go online and go to Find My Representative, and it'll ask you to put in your address and your zip code, and it will tell you who your member of Congress is. If you go to loc.gov, that's Library of Congress, you can actually go and see what bills they have sponsored, what legislation they have sponsored, what that has said. And you can ask yourself, you know, did they put their money where their mouth was? They made you some promises in order to get your vote. And you can go and see online how well or poorly they have decided to keep those promises. And then you can contact them, right? So there are a lot of forms that you can fill out on an individual congressperson's website. But one of the things that interns say, and like I was an intern, is anything that's handwritten or printed out that gets sent to an office is given priority, but so are phone calls. And if you hate calling and talking to people on the phone, you can call after 6 or 7 p.m. and just leave a message, right? But you can also email, you can also fill out those things and get in touch. One of the things I recommend is picking an issue that matters to you, making yourself a nice little form email, and tweaking it every week, or if you have the time, every day, and just making that 5 minutes to be like, oh, firing this off to you again until you fix it. All right, you know, don't be part of the problem. Be the whole problem. That's the goal, right? That's our job. Our job is to be the whole problem for Congress and make them work for us because we pay them. So as we get into the Senate, we'll talk about how that works next week on Article 1, Section 3, and see what we can see of what's going on with the guys who think that they're the big kids in the houses of Congress. Until then, keep the civic flame burning bright, and thank you for joining the good fight. The Civic Flame is a product of the Dr. Fun Sponge Media Corps with sound producer Matthew Munyon and creator Amber Veo.